Testing.
Okay. This is another lecture in the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture Series, which if you've been paying attention, we've had Noam Chomsky here, Vijay Prashant, and Gary Lewick thus far. To name Norman Finkelstein coming up, Rick Wolf, just to name a few others. Now, the Howard Zinn Memorial Lecture Series is obviously named in honor of Howard Zinn. They believe very much in radical education and in pretty much food for your brain. And I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Chad Montree, who is the author of A People's History of the Environmental Movement, which I'm sure will be a very interesting talk. So, Chad, come on up.
So thanks for having me here. So this book, People's History of Environmentalism, just came out, and I have copies if you'd like to pick up a copy, but I also put one over in the library if you're one of the occupants here, and I'd rather just read it for free. That's one of the options. The book is titled A People's History of Environmentalism because the idea is to sort of take Howard Zinn's perspective of doing history from the bottom up and revise the story that we have sort of in his labor history. And in fact, that's kind of really what I've been trying to do for the last few, 20 years of the time that I've been engaged in this kind of thing. I came to history really as an activist. I never really thought of myself as going to be, you know, somebody who's going to do what I do now, teaching, writing books. I was really interested in trying to be engaged in different types of social in order to understand what's going on in the present, in order to sort of make a path for the future. So that's kind of what I had in mind when I wrote this book. Like I said, you know, my interests have been particularly focused on trying to blend labor history and environmental history, trying to take two fields that really have been separate and bring them together, bring the perspectives that they have together. And the other thing, of course, is that we have to think about work, that work is one of the most important ways that people have a relationship to the environment, especially in the 19th century and in the early 20th century. When I first started in graduate school trying to think about how these two fields might be wedded together, there really wasn't anything in the academic literature, let alone sort of the mainstream press, that did this. But that has changed in the last few years. Actually, there's some really good examples, excellent examples of books and articles that do this, that put class and put work into the story. Carl Jacoby, who's at Brown University, did a book called Crimes Against Nature, which looked at the way that conservation policy that's coming from the federal level in the late 19th century, early 20th century, is really being imposed on people, and he uses three different case studies. It's really being imposed on people in local levels who already have a way of thinking about their relationship to nature and regulating that relationship is what he calls a moral ecology. And then conservation policy sort of supersedes that. And if necessary, what they do is they use coercive power of the state in order to make sure that they have, because those people that are first policing the national parks are being pulled off of Indian wars in the Plains states. They're being pulled out of the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. John Kumbler wrote a book called Reasonable Use that came out just a few years ago, which is about the Connecticut River Valley and the way that that's polluted during the 19th, early 20th century as a result of industrialization. And he talks about how in the 19th century people are already trying to deal with water pollution, especially, and there are laws being passed even in the state of Massachusetts in 1878 to address this. Elizabeth Blum did a book on Love Canal, which really revises the story that we have about Love Canal. This is the place where the Hooker Chemical Company put a bunch of chemicals in a canal, and then they leased, or I think they sold the land for a school to be built on top of it for a dollar. And then after a while, the rains and everything else sort of brought those chemicals to the top, and people started getting sick. And then Bachi takes classes and race and reinvestigates that and finds a whole different story, including the role that many people played through their unions in trying to deal with what was going on at Love Canal. So one of the things for me that was interesting about all this literature is the way that it opens up a new path for us, or a new sort of window on how to understand the origins of environmentalism. And like I said, what I want to do is try to think about the origins of environmentalism in terms of the role that working people play in that, and putting that. I think that's important for us. It's not just people who are sort of, if you're an historian, it's obviously interesting to try to find, you know, more valid interpretation of the past, but it's important for us, people who are activists, people who are here, people who are doing other things, because we have to have a good foundation, a good understanding of the past in order to make a class-conscious movement that's dedicated to not just economic justice, but also environmental sustainability. We have to put those, celebrate the anniversary of Earth Day. It's what people are saying on websites, but it's really fundamentally wrong. And it starts with the idea that Rachel is the thing that turns a lot of people on, changes people's consciousness, and primarily the idea is that her book is being read by middle-class people. I've never heard about that before. There's this notion sort of after World War II, there are all kinds of ways that people sort of get economic and social mobility that allows them to move these suburbs and allows them to think about the environment. And many of them start joining these mainstream environmental groups like the Sierra Club. And in fact, you can see that if you look at the graph of membership. Sierra Club and other organizations do have a lot more members by the end of the 60s than they started with. And there are other organizations that are started in the 60s like the Environmental Defense Fund. Then there's, of course, this, as a result of this, a growing environmental constituency, and two senators, Gaylord Nelson and Edmund Muskie, they start organizing a thing called Earth Day, right? And the first Earth Day is April 1970, and that supposedly consolidates or solidifies this environmental constituency so that through the 1970s that Congress can pass a whole bunch of new legislation on air and water pollution, hazardous toxic waste disposal, Endangered Species Act, things of this sort. And then, of course, the other part of the story is in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, we get a new grassroots-based confrontational activism, starting with Love Canal, and then through the 1980s when another event happens in Warren County, North Carolina. And Love Canal, as I said, it's about burying toxic landfill in this very poor and predominantly African-American area. They would have, and this waste is going to be PCB-laden waste. And they try to block it, they don't block it, and then when they don't block it, they try to block the waste from being put into the landfill, and they don't succeed in that either. Those are the first people supposedly to also start talking about environmental racism. And like I said, this is pretty much what you hear everywhere. I think some of you probably at least heard about the role that Rachel Carson played or that the First Earth Day played in sort of kicking things off. But the new narrative, if we put working people in terms of the environmental movement, the 1962 date, publication of Silent Spring, is very important, right, in marking things. But if you look at some of the new work that's coming out and then some of the research that I've done myself in archives, you can see that working people have been engaged in environmental protests and have expressed environmental consciousness all the way back to the 1800s with the rise of industrial capitalism and the spread of industrialization and urbanization around the country. And those people don't necessarily call themselves some environmentalists, so it's kind of a little bit difficult to say that the environmental movement started in the 1800s, but let's just look at the 20th century. Already by the 1940s, auto workers in Michigan, through their union, the United Auto Workers, are trying to address air and water pollution. And they're doing this also with the help of their sportsmen's club, many hunters and anglers, people who are hunting and fishing, who have come from other parts of the country and have come to work in these auto plants, are already using those clubs and already using their unions to try to get the state of Michigan, and they succeed in this, to pass legislation to control air and water pollution. So this is 20 years before Silent Spring is published in 1962. But we don't know this, right? We don't think of Walter Reuther, who's the president of the UAW, as one of the leaders. They're doing a lot of coal mining. Coal operators begin to switch to strip mining or surface coal mining methods because that's much more efficient. You can get a lot more coal out of the ground with fewer workers. These days, if you've heard about mountaintop removal, you've probably heard that coal operators are saying, or energy conglomerates are saying, that we can't have environmental regulations on mountaintop removal because that'll get rid of people's jobs. Well, the whole reason why they went to surface coal mining in the first place was to get rid of people's jobs, right? It makes them more profitable. Well, already by the 1950s, there are people in Appalachian, eastern Kentucky, southern West Virginia, who are protesting to try to end what's called then surface coal mining, strip mining, contour mining, auger mining. And they do this because of what is, right? They're trying to put deep miners out of work. So they're very much involved in the campaign along with other people who aren't necessarily miners. By the 1960s, there are people in Appalachia who are using new confrontational methods. What today you might call environmental justice act, send him to jail. People broke him out of jail, basically, and then they started the group, and they decided they would commit themselves to nonviolent civil disobedience. she also stood in the way of a bulldozer, and these are sheriff deputies that are pulling her off of her land. This is November 1965. She actually had Thanksgiving dinner in jail. By 1967, there are people doing what's called industrial sabotage. In the dead of night, they're blowing up campaign to end strip mining in Appalachia already by the mid and late 1960s, well before Love Canal, well before the Warren County campaign. The other way that we have to challenge the old version of events is who is part of the story? Who gets included in the story that we tell? In terms of leaders, like I said, we could talk about people like Walter Reuther. We need to also talk about people like Tony Mazzacchi, who's one of the leaders of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. We need to talk about people like Robert Fetchner, who was the director of the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s, which is a very important part of bringing working class people into the woods and enhancing their environmental or conservation consciousness. Henry Ingersoll Bowditch, who is on the top down, that there are millions of Americans, like the people in Appalachia, like the auto workers, who are pushing their leaders and getting people addressing the health hazards in their workplaces as well as in their communities and making a campaign that today we now recognize as sort of an official sort of, which requires, of course, that the new workers be brought from rural areas into growing cities. So industrialization and urbanization are the two factors. Yes? Can I just wrap this up real quick? Sure. Okay. So industrialization and urbanization are the two factors that I would argue are more important than suburbanization in terms of making an environmental movement. So it's people who are getting exposed to pollution, and then the other part of this is they're feeling separated or alienated from happening at the local and national level, and then to act on that sensibility in a whole different manner of ways. So let me get back to sort of the practical implications of this, and we can just sort of open this up for discussion or questions. I think one of the most important things that we should sort of draw out of having a new story, having a revisionist narrative of the environmental movement is a new sort of way of thinking about this supposedly mutually exclusive choice between jobs and environment. This is the thing that people are always throwing at us, saying, well, you can't have both. You can't have people employed, you can't have a good economy, you can't have people that have a decent standard of living and have clean air and clean water. But if you, and I'm not going to get into all the details here, I could if we want to talk about this in the question and answer session, are doing things that suggest that there is a history of workers being both workers and environmentalists, that they don't have to be two separate things, that there is a precedent, there are many precedents, in fact, for thinking that workers can have an environmental sensibility, as I said, or an ecological consciousness, and they can act on that, because they have. And it's only at different periods of time when that's difficult that perhaps, the question seems to be as if there is really a mutual exclusive choice between jobs and environment. But then that is something that we need to think about more seriously, too, or more critically. What you see really is that labor has to act in terms of context. They have to act within the social and economic context which they're situated. They don't have an entirely free hand. And so if we want to have some type of reconciliation between the different forces that are out there in terms of the so-called environmentalists that are separate, workers that are separate, we have to understand each other's history. We have to understand where we're all coming from. We have to understand where we are right now in the present time. So I'll just leave it at that. If people want to sort of make some comments or ask some questions, I think we still have some time.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You talk about Kirk Sales in that book?
I don't talk about Kirk Sales. I don't know who that is, actually.
Kirk Patrick Sales?
Nope.
Okay. Pollute the earth by antifreeze and stuff. They had people drain the antifreeze and bring back the bottle and get a deposit back.
Right.
That would clean the environment a lot better.
Sure. Well, and they're trying to expand the bottle bill right now in Massachusetts. I don't know if you know about that. They're trying to, now that we have new things to throw away, they have to come up with new legislation to figure out how to recycle it.
No, but the thing in the antifreeze, people dumping it in the water supply and it's polluting everything.
Yep.
It's causing all kinds of trouble with the water. So what you do is if people buy antifreeze, they got to return it to the store.
Sure.
And that way they get a deposit back. And that would clean the environment.
But one of the things I was trying to argue here is that there's a limitation to what you can do personally to deal with environmental problems. That the assault on the environment is coming from a system that we're part of.
Some of the environmentalists in the suburbs we talked about might term white collar, whereas people working under industrial scale.
Sure.
So
the only way we'll do it.
Since you've been talking about workers a lot, the question would be, to what extent are white collar,
What's behind all this is that you could argue that the people oftentimes that work nature and transform nature might have the most environmental consciousness, because they're the ones who know it more closely, that have the most knowledge about it. People who are fishing with nature in a way someone else in an office tower is not. And that gets expressed in different ways. I mean, that's why some of these people drive SUVs up to big mountains and hike them and think they're out in nature, right? I mean, which is absurd. That you have to escape to nature, that you have to get in a car and burn fossil fuels in order to get to nature, right? Because you don't have enough of it where you are. And I think human beings need to have this contact. I think human beings have to have this relationship. And when they don't, then that has certain consequences. The other thing is, we all are implicated in what environmental problems happen in the world. Even if you're white collar, even if you're not mining coal, right now, there's coal being dug in two of the largest open pit mines in Colombia that's being sent up to the United States to be used. We're sending coal outside of the United States. Think about it. Okay. Are buried by a truck turning over on them. So, I mean, that's because these mines are run to make as much profit as possible. And they run them hard. They work their workers as hard as they can in order to turn a profit. So, I mean, they're just as much. We have to see them as exploited, just in the way we would any other group of workers.
I'm also thinking we have use some chemicals in factories that are very toxic to workers and cause all kinds of occupational diseases. And unions have been very.
Workers are the front line, right? They're the ones who are going to know what's going into the community before everybody else. And he finally convinced many of his members that this was the case and got them to be on board working with environmentalists who weren't necessarily seeing eye to eye with them, because they finally understood that if they're getting affected, then the rest of the community is getting affected, and that nobody should be getting affected in that way. It doesn't have to be that way.
You all may want to hear what she has to say. She's a renowned author and public speaker and oil spill expert, and one of the leaders in the movement to abolish corporate personhood. So she also wanted to address this, but I might want to join the conversation.
Sure. Do you just want me to go down there, or did you want to talk together, or what?
You can hang. I don't care.